1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 123, One Nation Under God, Who's God? By Claude J. Burtenshaw. Comments by Joseph E. Black.
I think we're supposed to have a chairman, and I don't see. She's a chairwoman.
Chairperson.
Excuse me. I don't see anybody. I guess our time is ready to go. With so few of us, we might ought to suggest we find another session, since all of them have picked an more interesting one. I really don't know how to present this, because I've learned long ago that whatever way I choose is the wrong way. I listened to a fellow not long ago present his paper, and when he got through, he said, "I asked my friends, how did I do?" And he was very reluctant, wouldn't say much. "Well, come on, tell me." "Well, all right then. I have 3 points then. Number one, you read it. Number two, you didn't read it well. And number three, it wasn't worth reading." So that I've prepared a paper doesn't really say much for me that I'm prepared, because I'm not sure that when I get through, you will have caught on to what I said. I remember teaching a class one time, and the students, I discovered quite early in the class, they had materials to read, and they didn't read them. And so after a few sessions, I said to them, "I think we ought to read this together, if you won't read it in preparation, because I think we don't discuss it well until you've read it." So I took the occasion the next 2 or 3 weeks to make sure they'd read it, and when they hadn't, I read it to them. The next quarter, when the class was listed over in the registration area, my class was listed with the number and the time and so on, and somebody had come along and written underneath, "Or read along with Claude." So I'm a little reluctant to proceed. Let me just tell you, though, how this whole thing came to me. I think early last November, a young friend of mine returned from 10 years' service in the Middle East. And he said to me, "You know, there's something very interesting about being in a foreign country." He'd been in Jordan and Syria and I think in Saudi with assignments. He said I had frequent questions asked frequently. How does the U.S. politics, or how is religion excluded from politics in the United States? He thought that was the most interesting observation. He wasn't sure he had made a very good answer to it, but they said the most significant thing about American politics is that religion was kept out. Almost the same time that I met my friend, I got a call from the Exchange Club, one of them here in Salt Lake. And they said once each year, we celebrate the occasion of inserting the word "under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance. And they said, "We do that because we want to celebrate their lobbying to get that phrase," they said, "into the Pledge of Allegiance." And they wanted me to talk to them about their restoration of God into American politics and a restoration of religion that they said once was gone, and now they were helping get it back. I also noted, as we were talking with the two groups, Americans didn't really know that they had a system without God, or what it was initially, or how it came about, and the Middle Easterners, they were sure that we had found a system without God. So I thought that was an interesting kind of topic, and the Sunstone people called me one day and said, "Had you been thinking of anything?" And I said, "No, I haven't, but I just had finished talking with on a topic, and I mentioned to them, why don't you do that for us then this time? And I can see it didn't interest anybody, probably not even my Middle East friends. And the question was difficult, so said my friend. And I thought I would like to talk about, and let me tell you about the difficulties. The first, there are two conflicting human pursuits to control, a church and the state. And sometimes they're hard to distinguish, but apparently we like to do it. The first control is needed to settle conflicts, requiring supreme, final, coercive power. The second is a control used to pursue wisdom, truth, right, requiring a supreme being and a revelation from God. The tool of both organizations, I should say this, the organization is the essential tool in both pursuits. State is the name given to the organization with supreme, coercive, punitive power necessary to control conflicts. Church, the organized religion, is the name given to the organization that controls the access to God or His kingdom, the here and the hereafter. There is sometimes a very easy interdependency between the two institutions, as their supremacies may be closely related in use. For example, when a king or a head of state, by claiming divinity, adds legitimacy to his controls, or when the church leader commands the army, he protects the righteous. Conflicts are thus more intense when God authorizes the war or the control effort and directs the punishment. Political conflicts often have been given divine approval. Religion, an often claimed source of morality and power, may turn an omnipotent God into a punitive state. These combined power relationships can be noted in recorded history. Christianity, however, permitted a religiously directed church-state separation. Jesus established his kingdom independent of the state, although he eventually fell under its control. State and Christianity were joined during the 4th and 5th centuries A.D., and most Christian-dominated nations remain religiously intermingled even today. The religious separation or exclusion in the U.S. political system, though unique, may not be as apparent as the Middle East observers thought. Most recent examples of the problem of religious exclusion to America occurred in 1992 and 95, when religious prayers, spoken and sung, were legally prohibited in state high school graduation programs. Even though the language of the Supreme Court in declaring the exclusion in the 92 case clearly says, religious belief is irrelevant to every citizen standing in the political community, our Middle East friends may be surprised by the confusion and the resistance among Americans about that court-declared separation. And they may even be more surprised when they note that one nation under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Their question of how and when, talking about the Middle Easterners, exclusion or separations, may be as interesting to Americans as it is to the Middle Easterners. The separating events with their unique British colonial settlement of America resulted from economic and religious conflicts of Western Europe. Each settlement of the 13 colonies was a varied mixture of economic and religious motivations. Protestant denominations organized from the 16th century Christian Reformation dominated the colonial settlements. Each colony was authorized and controlled by a British-granted charter. The 13 charter grants from 1607 to 1733 that permitted the religious choice, the distance from Britain, the American frontier, and the time lapse up to 1765 had brought feelings of independence to the colonists. The independence feelings were significant enough that when the 1765 Parliament Stamp Act was imposed, the stamp tax was imposed, and aroused intercolonial resistance marked the beginning of the U.S. political system. 28 aroused delegates from 9 colonies met in New York City in October 1765 in the Stamp Act Congress, initiating the uniting agenda for the future system. Now, I want to just stop and let you look at the outline. Did you all get a copy of the outline? I want to just discuss now with you so you can see, and I want to skip a lot of this so that you can have a chance to discuss it. What I'm trying to say, and I don't know if I need to use the board or not, I'm trying to say for a power source from which to justify their political revolt and with which to condemn the British government. The source of the Declaration of Independence found a power source, a creator that equally endowed all men with unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The word of a philosopher, John Locke, not the word of God. The European intellectual enlightenment, accepted by many congressional delegates, provided a non-religious power source useful for justifying a political rebellion. Rather than noting that religion was removed from American political beginnings, it may be more accurate to say that religion was omitted. It was not on the political agenda, neither as an issue of conflict nor as an available power source. The revolution had secularized American politics. Now, following that revolt, however, something quite difficult and quite different was needed to unite and control. Like the dissension that promotes rebellion, unlike the dissension that promotes rebellion, governing required unity and stability, a credible power source from which to justify control. In these peculiar circumstances, religion was more than omitted. It was unavailable. The document the delegates wrote at Philadelphia not only established as their first convention motion declared a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary, it also established a supreme law, one to control the government the Constitution created. The Constitution declared itself the super law, a built-in secular political supremacy superseding morality, natural law, and religion, or God. The First Amendment to the Constitution proposed by the First Congress emphasized this religious exclusion from the national government with, and I'm now quoting the First Amendment, "Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion," and then required a political neutrality between the competing churches by adding, "or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." With the constitutional system, the nationalist leaders established a non-religious, secular national state. They made no provisions for religion or its moral claims in the Constitution and specifically excluded it from political agendas. Now, note what the Constitution says. In Article 6, the Constitution's claim of supremacy is complete. Note the language. Quote, "This Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, And then it required, quote, that judges in every state be bound thereby, and that all officials, national, state, and local, shall be bound by oath of affirmation to support this Constitution. It then concludes with the reminder that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification for any office, unquote. The super law status of the Constitution is ensured by distinguishing the congressional lawmaking procedure provided in Article 1 from the constitutional law amending procedure provided in Article 5. An amendment requires two-thirds vote of congressional bodies and a ratification of three-fourths of the state. Supremacy is quite clear. I should add now, when I get to this point, that when the Constitutional Convention met in that summer of 1787, there were no provisions nor anything to provide for anything on the agenda about religion. It was totally absent from the convention. Nothing religious was ever discussed. When I say that, I needed to make an exception or two. James Madison, in his notes, and he wrote the most explicit notes of the convention, in those, in a couple of places, when he stated some of the problems that the new Constitution must provide for with its new government, religion became one of the factions that had to be controlled. That was the only mention of it in the minutes, and nothing about it was on the agenda. Here then, take your outline and look when I tell you now that, number one, there was no religion in the, nor no religious, it was not as a conflict, it was not as a power source in the intercolonial congresses. It was not in the Declaration of Independence, it was totally left out. The God it spoke of was a very neutral, natural God, and I tried to make clear at the beginning that religion is only religion when it's organized and becomes a church. None of that is even referenced in any of these places. So the Constitution then was written in a convention that made no mention either as an agenda item or as something to be concerned with, and then it wrote a document that provided for a system with religion totally excluded. Am I clear enough? What I'm saying, and I'm saying, so far I found no place from 1765 through 1789 that religion was included. It was totally omitted, but finally in the amendments, excluded. And so for my Middle East friends, I'm trying to find the place where I say it happened. It just didn't ever get involved with the system at all. Now, the Constitution is written, and it's to be the supreme law of the land. I must hurry, Joe, to get us out of here. Then we must then know then that, number one, religion was excluded from the delegated powers that gave the United States power. It was totally excluded. It wasn't mentioned at all. Second, it provided for its own supremacy. And then third, it excluded it from even getting on future agendas. Now, that's the law. That's the new supreme law. And that supreme law seemed to exclude the need of a religious kind of implication for anything that it had done. That being established now, establishing a secular, religiously neutral supreme constitution was an essential feature for beginning with the religious exclusion in the American system. That, however, was just the beginning. The Constitution that delegated functions and powers to Congress, the executive and the judiciary that it created, was also intended by the delegation to limit their powers. According to the 10th Amendment, powers not delegated to the national government were reserved to the states. How to enforce these constitutional assignments was not specified in the document. Many prominent leaders, however, were not surprised when the Supreme Court assumed the enforcement role. This supervisory court function is known as judicial review. The court assumed this review activity by declaring a congressional law unconstitutional in 1803 and voiding a state law in 1819. Of course, it took the Civil War to finally settle the struggle between the state, the 13, or the, by then the first 25 states, and the central government. Eventually, though, after the war, judicial review became an accepted and a unique feature of the constitutional supremacy in the U.S. political system, and thereby became the source of constitutional law. In its 200-year history, the Supreme Court has declared unconstitutional more than 200 congressional laws, about 40 presidential actions, and 1,000, more than that now, state laws. The review feature a second political arena. Now, as I stated all this, there's something quite significant about judicial review. We got a whole new arena. The first one was created by the Constitution for the Congress. It has its arena. But the second one, the first one is where law is made, and the constitutional arena is where law is unmade. But they're quite comparable, and they both play a very critical role in the American political system. The judicial review control creates a second religious exclusion feature in the U.S. political system. The judicial review, after nearly a century and a half, also became available to the court to respond to alleged intrusions into the political system. The first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, proved in 1789, were adopted as an appeasement to the opponents of the Constitution during the ratifying convention. It was a states' rights addition. The First Amendment, on the note noted above, excluded religion from the National Congress and for many years from the court's review. Even though the 14th Amendment in 1868 invited the nationalization of the Bill of Rights, it was not until the 1920s that the court began to include the Bill of Rights in its jurisdiction. Not until 1940, however, did the court review a state law that dealt with religious conflict. Since then, the court has used most often the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment for settling allegations about religious intrusion. Many of the conflicts have been within and about religious activities in states' educational system. The court has disapproved the use of classrooms and sometimes school time for religious teaching. Prayers in classrooms and graduation ceremonies, moments of silence, have been defined as religious and therefore excluded. The court has forbidden Bible reading, teaching the Old Testament creation story, displaying the Ten Commandments and other religious symbols. Some kinds of state financial aid to parochial schools have been also prohibited. Similar non-educational religious conflicts have been reviewed. The court has approved, however, most public meeting prayers and some public religion displays and slogans, such as One Nation Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and In God We Trust on national currency. The court's declaration and protection of the constitutional right of privacy, which has been used to permit human abortion, has brought opposition from many church leaders and their members. The religious claim of the right to life of the unborn fetus, in opposition to the court's decision, has not been acceptable to the court's consideration. These claims of religious intrusion are made in this same court-controlled arena that reviews non-religious constitutional issue. The court's inclusion of the Bill of Rights without the formal amending process amends the First Amendment to read, Congress and other lawmakers at state and local levels of government, that's the amendment, shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. How to quit this and let you talk about it. All I'm trying to say here now is that the most critical thing to keeping religion out of the political system is what the courts do, what you can take to the court because of what goes on. May I just probably ought to read this to you too. The court has allowed the Constitution's free exercise clause to excuse Amish children from high school age 16 attendance law, a Seventh-day Adventist woman from an unemployment compensation legal payment restriction, and a Jehovah Witness from a flag salute requirement. It's in this judicial arena which ensures the Constitution's supremacy, secularity, and religious neutrality that individuals and minorities are allowed to win. For example, in disallowing a prayer in the New York State School, the court accepted on its agenda, in its arena, a student complaint that a school prayer was an intrusion into the Constitution's secularly protected area. Each of the 20 or so religious cases brought to the court have come from minorities. Losers in the lawmaking arenas initiate the judicial procedures for restating their arguments in the judicial arena with the additional constitutional claims. These constitutional arguments come at the conclusion of the political process where the law impacts individuals, victims of law enforcement, and those neglected or excluded from the political processes, admitting them into the political arena. Have you all gone to sleep? This is what happens when I read. Wake up. A most insignificant issue may be used to exclude religious political intrusion. Through the court's control of its arena, it A, sets its agenda from the religious conflicts brought to it, B, defines religion, D, C, interprets the establishment and the free exercise clauses of the amendment, and then D, excludes religion, thereby protecting the secular integrity of the Constitution. I'm saying the most significant thing about keeping religion out of politics is in the judicial arena, run totally by the Supreme Court. It even decides what the issue will be and if they will consider it. Now, the court's control, the judicial arena, a legal and political one, is a central feature of this that I'm talking about. The court's control is protected from other political forces by, one, the difficult constitutional amending procedure, thousands of failed attempts to amend the Constitution, only 26 have made it, two, the life-tenured justices, and three, the strategic location of the court in the law enforcement procedure. The court is in a somewhat strategic and secure location to ensure that the secularity and supremacy of the Constitution. A third feature that excludes religion from politics is the system's ideology. You can take a look at the outline there and make sure now. I'm at the third one, and I'm now trying to tell you this is another critical one, and I don't know how to get this to you any quicker than to try to, and we're out of time, Joe. A third feature of the system that excludes religion from politics is its ideology. All political systems need an ideology to legitimize political processes, the making and the enforcement of laws. As noted above, religion in some form often has provided this legitimizing feature in many nations. For example, the belief in Jehovah in the prophets of the Old Testament was the political ideology of the nations of the nation of ancient Israel. Also, the various Christian religions provide the semblance of a political creed for many current European nations. For the United States, the Constitution provides the needed ultimate appeal, the basis for an ideology called constitutionalism. The belief in the Constitution's supremacy by the citizens make it so. The political system's effectiveness is dependent on the citizens' acceptance of the ultimacy of the creed. The credibility and stability of the system's laws are justified by the creed. The credibility promoting claims of the system were provided by the nationalists at the Philadelphia Convention and in their writings to delegates at the state ratifying conventions. Supremacy, the essential feature of law and enforcement, and proposed in the Constitution, was feared by the delegates at the convention. At Philadelphia and in one of the ratifying papers, the power-fear dilemma was explained, and the explanation became the basic principle of the creed. Enabling the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to control itself, this is a statement from James Madison, became the basic element of the nationalist reasoning. The nationalist designers explained that the self-control feature were built into the Constitution's governing arrangement. Quote, the Constitution had adequately partitioned or separated the powers to keep each division in its assigned place, then was the function of the Constitution. Constitutionalism, then, the secular ideology, the belief that explains and justifies the supremacy and provides the hope that the built-in controls will protect the citizens from political abuses. The arguments for the built-in features that convinced the delegates of the conventions that supremacy was needed and controllable became the fundamentals of the political creed for all Americans. These built-in fundamental features have become acceptable and recognizable as they're taught, preached, and written about by teachers, politicians, pastors, orators, lecturers, and journalists. These well-known fundamentals include popular sovereignty, separation of powers, federalism, checks and balances, equality, four freedoms, and even though not mentioned in any of them, judicial review becomes a part. The first of the four freedoms, religion, is central in the creed, which includes a secular, religiously neutral, and supreme constitution. The popular belief that everybody else's religion should be kept out of politics is a control feature for excluding religion from American politics. Constitutionalism, like the Constitution, is ever-changing. The most dramatic change in the Constitution since its beginning can be noted in the status of citizenship. Originally, blacks, women, Native Americans, and the poor were excluded from the electorate. Now, all of those once excluded have constitutional access to the system. Religious issues likewise have changed. Religion has changed from a state to a national issue, as also has the meaning political significance and the way it may intrude into politics. School prayers, along with all the other public school disputes, only recently were accepted onto the Supreme Court's agenda. Central to the evolving constitutionalism are the decisions and the opinions of justices of the Supreme Court interpreting the Constitution's ambiguous language and flexible principles. The establishment of the free exercise clauses of the First Amendment await interpretation with each new conflict. Regardless of the conflict or the court's decision, constitutionalism accommodates the changes. Americans believe in a changing constitution. Should I quit, Joe? There are two or three things that I wanted to say now about constitution. Constitutionalism is a very suggestive one, and I had here, I think, one of the most unique conflicts of the American constitutional system with religion was Mormonism. And that story is, it's a difficult one. I am not even going to read it to you. But it's, pardon?
I think you ought to spend a little bit of time on that.
Tell it.
They're not getting ready to get out yet.
Well, Mormonism is not the only religion which threatened the religious constitutional exclusion feature. But its confrontation is unusual enough to warrant an in-text footnote explanation. For 60 years, the Mormon Church collided with the U.S. political system from top to bottom and marks the beginning of the national government state church encounter. The church experience with the American political system is somewhat historically out of place. When the church was organized, religion was constitutionally, and to the disappointment of the church, a state, not a national issue. During its first 16 years, 1830 to 1846, the church was in conflict with other settlers and churches and with the state governments before state-church relationships were clarified. Religious freedom appeared in the states at the same time to both protect and reject the church. The church likewise was unclear about its political aspirations. It declared a belief in church-state separation, while at the same time appeared to join the two. Finally, after bitter, confusing conflicts, the church was driven in turn from the states of Missouri and Illinois. In the Western Territory, Utah, under national jurisdiction, the church-state relationship was even more unsettled. The church-dominated territorial settlement began seemingly with national approval, which confused the relationship. A cloudy 50-year confrontation followed between the church and the national government. The conflicts were about the church's policies and its political controls between members, non-members, church rebels, apostates, and church leaders. The conflicts were finally settled by a hostile territorial legislator, an unfriendly Congress, president, and the court. The Congress and the president used armies, denied statehood, wrote laws against polygamy, and arrested hundreds of church members and leaders, and finally confiscated the church properties for failure to comply with the anti-polygamy laws. The church's leaders claimed constitutional protection, justifying their disobedience on the religious free exercise clause of the First Amendment. The court's rejection of the church's claim, along with the congressional admission of the state of Utah, excluding with its constitution religion from Utah politics. This concluded Mormonism's constitutional confrontation. The church lost in all arenas. This all happened 50 or so years before the nationalization and the definition of the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. Constitutional supremacy and secularity came to Mormonism and to Utah long before it did to others of the United States. Good night, and I wanted to do the summary.
I think you better do the summary.
Note, then, on your outline what I've said. Religion was omitted from the first three intercolonial congresses. Religion omitted from the political secularization of the Declaration of Independence. Religion excluded from the Philadelphia Convention in the supreme secular and religiously neutral constitution. 4, religion excluded by the Supreme Court in its constitutional arena. And 5, religion excluded by and in by constitutionalism, the U.S. political ideology. This religious exclusion feature of the American political system gives meaning and makes possible freedom of religion, a cherished feature of the American political system. However, like the other First Amendment freedoms, to speak, to publish, to organize, religion is involved with belief aspirations and resistances to them, which unavoidably involve conflicts. Tolerance, religious and otherwise, is an essential feature in constitutionalism for maintaining non-hostile religious relationships that assist in keeping religious conflicts out of politics. We may also suggest to our Middle East observers that the religious fragmentation that impacted the church-state relationship at the founding of the American political system is even more fragmented today. The Supreme Constitution, with its secular constitutionalism, now includes the political aspirations of most American church members. This may be noted in the political patriotism expressed in American church meetings and celebrations. The secular constitutionalism with its ceremonial deism, wrote Justice Brenner in the Pawtucket case, what I talked about where they were talking about putting the creche in the Pawtucket city square. Anyway, he was opposed to it, but he still wrote, Congress language, he said, language must have been over, excuse me, read, this may be noted in the political patriotism expressed in the American church meetings. The secular constitutionalism with its ceremonial deism, which I passed over and didn't read to you, this is Justice Brennan's language, must have overwhelmed the U.S. Congress in 1954 when it inserted under God into the Pledge of Allegiance as the secular constitution did not delegate to Congress control over religion. Even more forbidding than no authorization was the First Amendment language, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. The secular Congress, therefore, can authorize a secular God. Even so, such an insertion would puzzle our Middle East observers if they noted church members' frequent recitation of the pledge in and out of church. Americans, however, are so immersed in secular constitutionalism that they hardly needed the Supreme Court to remind them that the insertion referenced a secular, religiously neutral ceremonial God and its religious gods, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, and Mormon, that cause conflicts. It's the religious God, excuse me. And these make it onto the Supreme Court's agenda and provoke secular political decisions. How different is a religious God from a secular one? Many loyal, religiously faithful Americans believe in the uniquely separated church and state because God directed the separation. For them, God inspired the politically tax-exempt income property used to support churches. This may be the same secular God that Congress inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance. This may be the same secular, religiously neutral God that gives constitutionalism its religious appearance. This may be the legally protected secularism that disturbs religious leaders for its seeming religious intrusion. How real, then, is the church-state separation in the American political system? Are our Middle East observers inaccurate in their observations? With the material presented in this article, I would agree with our Middle East friends and the church-state separation belief of most Americans. I must agree, however, that the judicial explanation of the religious exclusion may be unclear with the divisive decisions of 9 court justices. They don't agree on anything. But essential features of the religious separation is uniquely arranged, and its religious neutrality of the Supreme Constitution with the Supreme Court's in the Supreme Court's separate political arena. The secular patriotic God must be found somewhere in that political supremacy. With that supreme religious neutrality, freedom of religion is possible. Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't get through. Go ahead. You may have to stay another hour.
Now we have another panel coming in here in a few minutes. I want Professor Burtonshaw, a good friend Claude, to know I did read your paper. Three times, and so you can give me credit for that. In fact, this good presentation, done so very well on the Constitution and on the role of religion in our Constitution, I think was handled so well that even though you thought you were running over, I just wanted to be sure that you give each one of us 1 hour of academic credit for this, and we will forgive you all the rest of it.
No, since we...
Well, I don't know. I think that you are secularly patriotic and neutral in the way you did this. No, there are some unusual points in here. My name is Joseph Black. Quite a few of you know me. and we didn't have a regular chair here, so I kind of feel like doing that. And given the amount of time that's available, I'm not going to raise the number of points that I have written down or comment on them, because I would like in just a moment to turn it over and have people in the audience have you have a chance to ask Claude any questions that you do. Because each one of them, I do agree with the paper. I don't know of another description of the role of religion in the Constitution and the establishment of constitutionalism that puts this as clearly as as in this paper. And so if you don't have a copy of it, I really would do it and read it if you're referring to this, because it does very well. And the steps in here that I have not read before, even though as a political scientist I have read a lot on the Constitution, but his comments on, I kept smiling, almost chuckling, as he talked about a secular God, a secularly neutral God, a religiously neutral God, and a whole series of things. Very seldom do you find these kinds of statements as you talk about one nation under God, and that people of very different concepts or religions can do it. Well, a neutral, secularly neutral God. I'm just going to raise one point, and then if anybody has questions, let's do that for a few minutes. Because the one of religion in politics, even though I've been lived in a lot of Islamic countries and have seen the furiosity sometimes of politics, but even where you do have religion intruding right into the state, politics is still there all the time, including in Islamic countries, on whether or not you should have the Islamic law or something else, and then people trying to live with that. So the one of religion and politics still is there all the time, just as religion and politics is in our... There was one phrase he talked about, and that was religion excluded from politics. Well, the organized church is, but religion is not excluded from politics, at least in my understanding of what is happening in politics right now. The religious right and lots of groups are squarely into politics. A very interesting article in The Economist from London, Come Holy Spirit, the Counterattack of God. And this just came out the other day, Claude, but it's very interesting to me to see the ever-perceptive Alexis de Tocqueville observed in 1835, religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society, but it must be regarded as the first of their political institutions, back in 1835. I find that interesting for de Tocqueville. No, you do have the separation of church and state, but the role of religion in politics as a political institution is always there. On the one on Mormonism in politics, I was going to make a little comment, but it's interesting to me the number of different books written by LDS authors that almost, they will say, these wise men were raised up to create this kind of a constitution so that this church could be established. Then as it goes on in the discussion, it almost says, this constitution was made this way to allow this church to exist and to flourish. So even though they agree with this constitutionalism, there is kind of an amendment that goes on as it explains what this really is. I'm very happy to be here. And I would like now to just turn it over and let any of you who have questions you would like to ask Claude refer them right to him. Claude.
Did you find until like 1920? What really, 1940 was the first church case, first religious case to get into the American constitutional system. Before that, back in Ohio, in Illinois, Ohio and Missouri, the conflict there was with the state governments, and it was with them, much to the chagrin of the church, they wanted to go to, well, they went to Washington, they went there a number of times to get help to protect them in their religious beliefs. But three or four presidential candidates and the president at the time that they went, Van Buren, they said, we can't do anything for you because the Constitution leaves control of the church, of religion, to the states. So the encounter then is about the arrangement of the Constitution in its earliest days in those states. When they moved to the territory, the Congress of the United States, the President, and the courts have total control over territories. And they exercise that, and in it, Mormonism or Mormon leaders and use the First Amendment to claim their protection for religious or for their kind of worship. And they lost in about 5 or 6 Supreme Court cases. They lost to Congress with all the laws that they imposed. They lost to the state legislature and everything it did. I mean, it was a pretty big encounter with the constitutional arrangement of these. Those were totally religious issues then. So the Constitution keeps the U.S. government or any of its subdivisions out of the conflict about their dispute. You're talking then about political intrusion into the church government. Is that what you mean?
Well,
I'm not quite sure of how the issues came, but there were some early issues, and even some later ones, where there became a dispute within the church. And the court would accept it if it were about property, the settlement as to which body of the church gets the property, or which body of the church can dispose of some other things that the church has. And then they tried to establish a doctrine that would help settle a dispute that the church couldn't settle. But they kept themselves out of a theology. They've kept them out of any kind of governance issue of the church. And they have a couple of doctrines they've developed trying to do that. But their issue is to, but their attempt and their policy is to keep themselves out of the church dispute. And occasionally,
one of the possibilities is you're going to the court.
Well, to lose, you see, you have to lose somewhere, and that being a loser, then you appeal it. If that's what Lamar is saying, that's how you get on their agenda, is appealing a loss.
Maryland had succeeded in ignoring the court, which is what we all ought to do.
Well, if they did, if they did and got the state involved in the settlement, then I'm not quite sure that they're out. That must be the thing we're talking about. And I'm not quite sure what the issue is that would permit them to be in. But it can't be a religious one, according to the Supreme Court. This is an interesting question that Latter-day Saints have always dealt with. They always refer to the prayer in the Philadelphia Convention. On about the 28th of June in 1787, after they'd been going a whole month, Ben Franklin was quite concerned with what looked like was going to break up the convention. He said, "I think we ought to appeal to divine authority, and I suggest we have a prayer." It was seconded. Then a discussion took place, all kinds of queries about this will suggest weakness, or this will admit foreign powers, or who will pay for the chaplain, all those kind of things. And finally it said, why don't we, on the 4th of July, which was coming up, why don't we just have a little celebration and let that have prayer in it? But finally, when they got all through, they didn't even vote on the motion. So there was never a prayer in the Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia.
And is that at one point is quoted as saying, and I've read this in Madison, "I move that we proceed without foreign intervention."
He said that at the conclusion of the debate. Yeah, this is quite interesting. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were in disagreement with George Washington and John Adams over having national holidays and have prayer, over doing other kinds of things in a fast and all those. Jefferson and Madison said those were totally non-political activities and should never be done. But they went on, and different presidents have done them differently. All we can conclude, and the court even had about the prayers in the Nebraska legislature, they said there, and like I want to say now, those prayers have no religious significance. And in my paper, I try to discuss something else about those prayers. At some point, and I have a Supreme Court say that we do a lot of things for their ceremonial deism, he calls it. Deism means that you have a God that creates a world and turns it loose to run by itself. He said our American system is full of these kind of routine ceremonialisms, which I think was their way of saying that the creche in Pawtucket could stay because it had no religious significance. And the same thing you say about a lot of religious things we do. We seem to do them in a way they don't matter religiously.
I want to thank you a lot, Clyde.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.